You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek, The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is... Sorry, it's Sub Rosa. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
I'm Jane from London.
And guess what? We got Chris on with us somewhere. Wait, and not only do we have Chris, we also have Chris. Take it away, boys. Whoever talks first wins.
Whoever talks first gets the moniker of Chris for this episode.
Yes.
Oh, you've scared him off.
I guess I'll talk first. Since I'm the American, the pushy American here. I just poured my glass of scotch, 15-year aged scotch. And I'm prepared for a fantastic conversation about a fantastic episode.
That is Chris from South Carolina? North Carolina?
South.
South.
South. Okay, good. Why did I hedge my bet?
He tells us right. Each time he tells us.
Yeah, that's true. That's why I'm saying, why did I hedge my bet? I knew it was South Carolina. Chris from South Carolina. And do we also have a Chris here?
We do indeed. We have a Chris from Glasgow as well. Fitting for this episode, I would guess.
In Scotland, I think.
Yes.
Or is it on this colony that's pretending to be Scottish?
The Kaldos. Yeah. We could be. Was it Kaldos or Kaldos?
I couldn't look at it. Kaldos, I think.
Okay.
Sounds like an operating system.
All right. So let's start with Mr. Johnson. How are you? Have you been lately? I got to look up when the last time we talked. But it was not too long ago. Yeah,
not too long ago at all.
Yeah. That was
we're making a habit.
Inheritance is the last time we talked. So how have you been?
I've been good. School is almost over. We're about to be completely finished for the year. Yeah. And COVID restrictions have kind of lightened as more people get the vaccine or have caught the thing and have the natural immunity. So we're doing all right here in South Carolina.
Okay. Well, without giving too much information and violating HIPAA laws, how many of your students throughout the year actually got the virus?
I honestly don't know the numbers. It wasn't many of our students that had positive cases.
That's good.
But a lot of our parents in the rural area there wouldn't have taken their kids unless they were absolutely sick. So we all know I deal with, 10, 11 year olds and they do not show symptoms as bad from this. So there's that as well. So who knows?
So they could have had it, not even knew it.
Right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Here where I'm at in Nebraska, some schools are already done. So I just had a drop off of something. Hold on, guys. I'm glad James was recording this because I had a severe drop-off. I'm frozen. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. We can hear you.
I'm completely
frozen. It's surprising
that
schools are finished so early in the US because, we've just braked for half term. So I think we've got another 6 weeks on the back end of after we return at the beginning of June. So we're not out until like mid-July. Which I think is stupid, I have to say.
When do you go back?
The start of the year is first week of September.
Whew, so you get like a month off?
Yeah, well, about 5 to 6 weeks or so.
The arbitrary number they've decided on in America is 180 days.
That's what, for summer break?
No. 180 days of schooling has to happen.
Okay.
I thought you meant the school summer holiday was 180. No. It's 104, if I remember rightly, from Phineas and Ferb.
So the strange thing is that when I was younger, I didn't go to school in England, or at least not for the entirety of the time. So when I was like 10 or so, I went to school in Spain, and we had the entirety of June, July, August, and pretty much half of, you know, well, a tail end of September and May as well. So we had this huge chunk in the middle of summer, and I honestly, I think that's awesome. I don't know what my parents would have thought about it, and especially now, it's, you know, having your own kids, it seems a bit I'm always in two minds. I think the kids are quite tired at the moment, given the year that they've just had, but at the same time, that when they come home for some holidays, I don't know what we're going to do to keep them happy and entertained and not fighting. But anyway, that's all. So when do you guys go back in the US? So you guys start like end of August or mid August, right?
Yeah, in South Carolina, it's mostly mid August. There are other states that go back beginning of September.
So the reason why I know that some of you at least go early is that I'm having a bit of a midlife crisis, I have to say. And when I say a bit, I mean it's significant. It really is significant. And as part of that, I've booked Disneyland or Disney World in Florida for next year, and I'm going towards the end of August, which is when my birthday is. But I am told that most of the U.S. kids are no longer out of school, so it's relatively quiet, despite it being hurricane season, and you know, certainly the temperature that can burn an Englishman at a stake.
Yeah. You're going to be very hot.
Yeah. Lou, are you back? No, Lou's not back. Doesn't look like he's back. Hold on. Okay, so I need to keep going. And
the other Chris.
Sorry? Yeah, what did he say about the other Chris? I was about to ask the other Chris something.
It's his time to introduce himself.
Indeed. So, other Chris, Kieran McDuff, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, yeah. I'm just thinking, I think the Scottish schools are slightly different again, because we have about 4 weeks left. So that's the end of June they finish up. But we go back mid-August. So it's probably the same length as the English holidays, but it's skewed slightly to the... It's brought forward slightly.
So the thing that I'm... it's particularly interesting for... Or not, it's that not that interesting, I have to admit. I have a very late August birthday, and as a result, I'm the youngest in my year by... I mean, I suppose I'm not necessarily the youngest in the year, because someone could have been born on the same day, but I'm pretty much the youngest. And that's always been something that I've kind of always carried with me. But had I gone back to school, or had the schools gone back mid-August, I might have had to have gone into a more junior year. That would have been terrifying. I kind of feel, as a person, I prefer to be the youngest and the oldest in the year. But anyway, that's... I know that's like personal preference.
Hey guys, how am I sounding now?
You're sounding awesome.
Oh, jeez. Everything seemed to have gone offline except for I could still hear you. I had to pull my video plugs, my audio plugs. I had to put I have a USB hub. I had to take the keyboard and microphone off of and go directly to the computer. That was weird. So obviously I'm not recording any of this. So thank you, James.
Well, okay, hail the Skype.
That's right. And I always thought you guys across the pond was year-round school with various breaks here and there.
No. No, I mean, we have a summer break.
Oh.
I think that they, it's for another time. I mean, given what we've just gone through in terms of the year that there has been with a lot of people, working from home, having remote schooling, et cetera, I suspect there are probably things that they can do to make schooling a little bit better and kind of refocus it for the 21st century. But, anyway, that's for another discussion.
Okay, well then, let's go back into the episode, if you guys are ready for it. I will pretend that I'm prepared and I'm not having to do this on the fly here because everything got screwed up. Okay, Sab Rosa. This is the 14th episode of Season 7 of TNG. It was first aired on January 31st, 1994. Teleplay by Brannon Braga. Story by Jerry Taylor. Well, that explains some of it. And based on material by Gina or F. Gallo. Directed by Jonathan Frakes. Ugh, I'm so sorry, Beard. Let's see. Guest stars for this episode are Michael Keenan as Maturin. Shea Duffin as Ned Quint. Where do they come up with these names? Duncan.
hey, this is a proud Scottish name.
Okay. Duncan Rager as Ronan, and co-starring Ellen Dow as Felicia. And I don't hear any computer voices. I don't remember any computer voices, so Magil's not here today. So what do we think of this episode? Let's start with Mr. Johnson. What do you think about this episode, sir? Briefly.
This episode
put the scotch
is...
down.
This episode is fantastic. Aside from the fact that they had to go and be completely... rationalist enlightenment people and give this a sciency name at the end. They couldn't just say, oh, this is mysterious, this thing. They had to name and define it in order to defeat it. So I thought that it was a fun little tropey horror / creepy romance episode. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
You in a nutshell, huh? You make a good couple. All right. Mr. McDuff, you're next. What's your brief thoughts?
I have mixed feelings about this episode. I think I've mellowed over the years. And I don't think... I used to hate this episode. I don't think I do now. There are still major problems, and we'll come on to them. But it's Star Trek. It's hard to be bad Star Trek.
Okay. All right. Then I'll go next. I'm speechless, bud. Guys, I'm speechless. The day I've dreaded for years has finally come.
What problem do you have with this episode? What problem?
The writing, the story, the acting. I'm sorry, this ain't Gates' finest work.
Well, she's barely been used this season, has she?
Maybe that's the reason why she's a little rusty. It just for some of this. No, we got to get into the story before we really give too much away. But obviously, I've been a sinner, and God is punishing me for my sins now. So okay, Doc, you go next. Let's see.
This. So first of all, just to be clear, this isn't the greatest episode of Star Trek, right? You're not watching The Defector or Duet or Best of Both Worlds or All Good Things and say, actually, I want a bit of Sub Rosa. That doesn't tend to happen. But it's not the worst thing in the world, is it? I mean, I don't know if I used to hate this episode, or I used to be indifferent to this episode, and was then told that I had to hate it because it's kind of, the rage to be annoyed with this episode for some reason. But I don't think it's that bad. I mean, there are a couple of things that are just ridiculous, like Fog on the Bridge. But if you park some of that nonsense, this isn't too bad. Is it?
How about this? Instead of we discussing Sub Rosa, why don't we just redo? Oh goodness, what was that episode? Shades of Grey. Let's redo Shades of Grey because it's a lot more interesting.
No, Shades of Grey is worse than this.
Yes, Shades of Grey is worse than this. And Code of Honor is worse than this. And some of the painful Troy episodes are worse than this. Right, Man of the People. Is it? It's not Man of the People. It's the other one. It's the Violations one with the, that nonsense. This is fine, right? And actually, I'm going to disagree with our American Chris here and say that what they basically have here for like 45 minutes or so, it is the ghost story. That's what's set up with a little bit of Trek every now and again to remind people that, Worf and Data are still there. And then right at the end, of course, they do have to like wrap it up as he wasn't a ghost. He was a type of alien with this particular energy and blah, blah, blah. They kind of need to do that. So I kind of forgive that. And I don't know, I think personally I require Star Trek to be in the rational world, not in the mystery world. And I think this even extends to the stories that we get in Deep Space Nine with the prophets and stuff like that. So I am slightly at odds with our friend here, but but yeah, this isn't too bad, right? This isn't...
I'm with you with as it regards the episode being great, but as a rebuttal a little bit, the problem with that I have with this episode is that it's too neat, shiny, clear, and easy. All of a sudden, she finds this thing out that nobody's been able to find out. The thing that I love about the prophets and the Deep Space Nine stuff is that while they do attempt to define it, it's never fully defined. There is still mystery there. These beings are beyond what they can truly like grasp at fully. And so I think the Deep Space Nine stuff is done better because it's nuanced and it's balanced.
Of course it is. And you obviously have many, many years in order to like lay out that story. And I never feel that, to be clear, I don't have a problem with a bit of mystery per se, but I don't like the idea. But in DS9, you always got the impression that if people studied the prophets hard enough, they're not reduced, and also cute to a certain extent as well. You're not always just reduced to, hey, it's magic, right? That's not what you're being asked to put your faith in.
But I love a little bit of magic deep in the bones of a thing, just the undefinable essence. And we still have that in the world today, thankfully. I don't know that I want to live in a world that is clearly defined everywhere and understandable in all ways.
So also they don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that there should be a lack of mystery, but right. I think that as a scientist, I kind of start from an axiom that you can at least attempt to explain it without you don't have to yield to the mystery. You can continue to investigate, continue to learn, and hopefully continue to push boundaries of knowledge. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is clean and there aren't issues about, it's still things that are yet to unfold. But I like living in that world, and I prefer living in that world than accepting that there are things that are unknowable or effectively you're being asked to believe in some type of higher being is probably the wrong way to think of it, because I think that there's a lot of connotations that come with that. But what I mean is that things that are unknowable to ourselves, and not just now, but for forever. Anyway, Glue, come on, let's start the show.
I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go when you are.
Now, every good show starts with a funeral, doesn't it?
With the what?
With a funeral, with a burial.
Oh, of course. That's the best way to start. Especially one that's... Okay, so... I did not go through Memory Alpha on this to see if there's anything about where this was filmed, but...
It wasn't filmed in Scotland.
It was not?
No.
Okay. Because I was wondering, Where do they, did they like find a grave site and just film there? Is this on a soundstage? What?
We're on the set of Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
I have no idea what that is.
But I don't know if that's a joke.
To film this in Scotland, they would have needed a time machine.
It was a joke. Darby O'Gill and the Little People is a Disney movie from the, I don't know, 60s, I guess, with Sean Connery. So, yeah, anyway. Sorry. The three people who laughed at that when I actually said it that are listening now, I hope you enjoyed it. Sorry to see you
guys. Yeah, that was for you. And you know our audience is smart because the three people that got it were the only three people listening. So they're good. All right. So it's not just any funeral. It's Nana's funeral. And I take it that from the dialogue that Mama went before Nana. Correct?
Yeah. They explicitly mentioned that Crusher's mom had died and she was raised by her grandmother.
Okay.
But this is good continuity, though, because all the way back in season one in the Arsenal Freedom, it was mentioned that Beverly's Nana was a healer. So that's okay. Good. Top and tail of TNG.
Right. When I say healer, they mean doctor, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, because there was a bit at the end when Crusher kind of decides that she's going to jack it in with Starfleet and she's going to become a healer. I mean, it's like she's almost saying, well, I'll have to retrain as a healer. So, look, you're just a doctor. There's no problem with you becoming a doctor in this particular colony.
I think the idea of a healer is they use more traditional methods as opposed to what, tricorders and hyposprays and things like that.
Oh, and this must be the woman that does all of the chicken soup and yes, all of the stuff that's been put forward by Crusher over the seasons.
Yeah, lots of essential oils is what I imagined.
Hmm. Okay. Well, anyway. So then, if Mom went first, but they said that this anaphasic ghost or whatever you want to call him has been going through the Howard women for how long?
800 years.
800 years. Wow, that is a lot of Howard women. So does that mean that he, I don't know, what do you want to call it? He was with Mom first before Nana?
I think he skipped Mom.
Yeah, I think he skipped Mom.
The point they make later on is all the Howard women had those terrific green eyes, which is supposedly tied to him, except for Beverly herself and her mother. So the implication there is her mother never had anything with Ronan.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that makes perfect sense. So
see, there's hidden depth in this episode, Lou. You're not appreciating.
I suppose you're right. But I am kind of scrolling through Memory Alpha to try and see what I could find a little more about it. And this name comes from Latin, under the rose. So, interesting. So, during the funeral, a strange man who she describes as a handsome or good-looking man, which I don't know about you three, I tend to disagree with. He doesn't look very handsome to me.
What? You're going to complain about the guy's looks. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I don't mind. I mean, we know him better as Shakar. So Kira obviously has a thing for him as well. But I don't have a problem with him being considered good looking by these women. I have a problem with him being considered 34. That's What's a wrong? Hard paper route.
Okay. How old was he at this point? I mean, he's 42 at this point, it looks like. He's a 52 birthday, and this would have been 94.
Yeah, so that would be keeping him with him looking older than me currently, and I am definitely beyond 34. So yes, I have a problem with him being considered 34.
I always find it hard to see Shakar in this guy.
I didn't at all till you said that.
Yeah, but even with that knowledge, I find it hard to see it.
Well, yeah.
I just don't. It's an odd one. He's very different. But probably because he's no longer 34 at that point. He's at that point, he's mid-40s.
Yeah. I didn't get that at all until you guys mentioned that just now. So he throws a chameleon flower in her casket. What do they mean by chameleon? It changes colors or what?
No, it's just the name of the flower, right?
Okay.
And it's not chameleon. Chameleon.
No, oh, I thought it said chameleon, as in, you know, something that can change its, you know, color.
No. Just a particular flower. Look, I'll link you to the Wikipedia.
Oh, gee, thanks.
it's just that. It's nothing more than that. It's nothing special. Except that it's Nana's favorite.
Oh, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so the journal. She finds Nana's journal.
I've said nothing about the journal until we get to 10 forward.
I have to say, no, you're skipping over something here, Luke, because I think it's, again, I don't know how our Scottish Chris is going to react to this, but Picard explicitly is talking to the governor. He is the governor, right?
Yes.
And he says, you're clearly not Scottish. That's a bit racist, isn't it? I mean, what he's not wearing, he doesn't have like big red hair and he's wearing a kilt instead of like Groundskeeper Willie or something. What? Why couldn't he be Scottish?
I rather assumed it was because he wasn't human.
But do you have to be human to be Scottish?
Well, no. I mean, he does go on to say that he visited Scotland, and I think he name checks Glamis Castle.
Yeah.
Which is a real castle in Angus, their forfar. And then he said, so he enjoyed the Scottish Highlands. I don't think he ever lived in Scotland and ever called it his home, but hey, if you want to call Scotland your home, you're as Scottish as anybody else, as far as I'm concerned.
But it's clear the, you know, like, if the guy had been black, you wouldn't have said you're clearly not Scottish. And clearly, the setup that they have in Trek, or the conceit they have in Trek, is that the different races are effectively playing out the human condition. So I just found it odd that they kind of pulled someone up on not being Scottish, because he didn't look stereotypically Scottish. That's what it was, because the other guy did, right? The guy with the other hat, he certainly was a stereotypical Scot.
Yes, and actually he was played by an Irish actor, but yeah, they do tend to chop and change with Ireland and Scotland quite a bit in acting terms. But yeah, he was quite clearly meant to be of Scottish descent.
Okay,
but you're right. I mean, it is possible that Maturin could have been. Maybe not first generation Scottish. That would have been a bit too on the nose, I think. I mean, they could have been half Scottish.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, I imagine we're the only guys that are certainly on this call that are going to get the reference. And maybe you weren't even. But the other guy, what was the other guy's name? The guy that got, huh?
Ned.
Oh yeah.
I got very strong wine gums guy.
Yes.
Anyway.
Hey, who is this man to walk in the house and blow out a candle? Huh?
That's one thing that, you know, you do have that scene where Crusher goes back to her house or her Nana's house. She's having a look around places. She's reading in the diary, and then someone just turns up and breaks in, and that's not nice, right?
He doesn't break in.
He
walks in. She didn't lock the door.
He's more comfortable with the home than she is. Like, it's effectively where he's been staying, taking care of her Nana. And that's verified later on in the episode. But also, he's the doomsayer. This is a scary episode, and he's like the old dude in Friday the 13th saying,
"Yes,
you don't want to go there, kiddies." Right? Like, he's that guy.
But the way that they, like, one of the problems that I have with the episode's, like, story is really about it feels to me like all of this, you know, caper could have been avoided had they just listened to the guy at the start. And considering that he rushes in a really crazy way and gives he gives Crusher no rope at all to trust him, right? Just running into the house and shouting out gibberish. It kind of just makes me feel that it's I don't like stories that happen only because of the stupidity of the actors involved or the people involved. And that's slightly frustrating with this guy being introduced at this stage.
But, okay, so you're a hyper-rational guy who's not had to watch this woman that he obviously owes some fealty to or has some great, like, I give them this conceit because I could see it, right? Like, this, it made sense narratively that this guy had watched this old woman. He had figured this out through many years of being around her and helping her around her house. He was probably driven mad by what I would call, in a normal horror movie, some type of demonic force. And at that point, he's just gone. Like, he has to stop this thing at any cost. And nobody's listening to him, right? Because he can't define it, because he's not got all the fancy words and all the fancy learning, right? Like, he's just a dude who was taking care of the grounds in the house for the lady who, you know, liked her a lot, and here he is. So I get it, narratively. I think it actually makes...
I don't think Ned ever did anything wrong in this episode. That's the thing. Right. The fact that he walks into the house might seem wrong to Beverly, but right. From his perspective, he's done that every day for however many years. So there's nothing wrong there. He gives her the warning, which, as it turns out, as the episode goes on, is 100% correct. He tries to stop them and gets killed in the process. So he doesn't do anything wrong.
No, but what is he trying to stop, right? You know, so it's the tragic situation of a woman living to 101 years old and having terrific sex with a 35-year-old for 70 years of her life. What a tragedy! I mean, it feels like this was a perfectly reasonable position for Nana to be in. Or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And Beverly makes this point right at the end of the episode as well. And it is very much what we've just seen. Was it really that bad after all? And you think, well, yes, given some of the things we do see. But yeah, the very thin layer of it is she lives a very long life and is very happy in that life. Is that really so bad?
But no, it is bad because...
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
She's never authentically in a community, and they don't really hammer this down like they should. If this was a good 2-hour horror movie, like it would let you know that this woman had been deprived of socialization because of this succubus that had kind of taken root in her life. Like, she was so given over to this thing that she could not have real, actual communion with people in her life. It was just her and the ghost or the demon or the, in this case, whatever the weird sciencey name they gave to it, right? Like, so she was overcome with it. Like, Beverly hadn't talked to her or seen her in how long, right? And that's part of it is part of the Star Trek whatever, but like, you should still be able to talk to your family, like text them or whatever. You should still be able to have real community with the people in this weird Scottish planet that you live on, right? But it doesn't seem... I don't know.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think one of the other things that this episode does show, it kind of hints at it without hitting you over the head with it, is how real are these feelings? So it all seems very real when he's part of you, and they're not separated in any way. But what happens towards the end of this episode is he hurts Picard. And that is the thing that kind of snaps Beverly out of, I'm going to be with this ghost guy, to he's hurt the person I really care about. So her real feelings for Picard are the thing that snap her out of it. And as soon as she starts, as soon as he starts messing about with her grandmother's body as well, she goes tearing after him and doesn't hesitate to shoot, really. So I do question how real these feelings are that, yes, her grandmother wrote about, but her grandmother was under a spell when she wrote all that stuff.
Hmm. Okay. So Nana had a lover at 100 years old. Okay. Yeah. What a cougar.
So the next bit is when we get up to the Enterprise, right? So Beverly eventually goes up. She has a rather intense night, shall we say. And then she has a chat about it in public with Troy. Now, I have to, I like this stuff.
Yeah.
Am I wrong to like this?
Yes.
No. Go ahead.
This is rape.
Yeah.
This is the problem. This is the fundamental problem I have with this episode. This is rape. It doesn't put the name on it, but it's rape.
Do you think that this thing caused the dream? Like he was in the dream?
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to whether or not you think that this is a dream.
I never made that connection. So I assume that this was like some resonant like energy from the notebook. Did she have the candle in the room at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
And it lit up?
No, it was out.
I thought that it lit up the next, when she had the real experience with it the next night, but she had sort of consented because she enjoyed it so much. So this scene, the reason I like it so much is because this was the scene of her consent. This was the scene where she was like, I had this crazy dream about it, and I think I kind of like it. Like, I want to meet this guy. Like, I want this same sort of relationship. So I don't know. I didn't see it as rape, or I would have been really grossed out and probably turned off by this whole episode.
But I think the problem is she thinks it's a dream. She doesn't realize this is actually happening, and it's happening by a creature of some kind that she's never ever had any interaction with until this point. And the first thing he does is arouse her.
That's fair. That is strange.
What? So I think that I think it probably would have, had the episode been made today, they probably would have wanted to have been very clear that there wasn't that this wasn't rape, right? That this was just her having read the diaries of her grandmother, having gotten, you know, aroused, having been swept up in the emotion of it.
Yeah.
Because you don't need it. You don't need it to be rape. You don't need it for the guy to actually have, you know, for her to have had the experience with the ghost. You could have just been all in her imagination, and I would like to believe that's what happened, because I think that the conversation that she then has with Troy, and, you know, the bit where she's reading the erotic diary, and I do have to say, I like the way it ends this, when they have the I wonder if I'll have another dream tonight, and Troy looks back and goes, I'd read two chapters. That, I mean, isn't that awesome?
I will give a lot of credit to Marina Sirtis in this scene, because the facial expressions alone sell it. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And there has to be some reaction to the immortal line of, I did fall asleep reading a particularly erotic chapter in my grandmother's journal. Yeah. She wrote very detailed descriptions of her experiences with Ronan.
Hold on. I don't think it was a dream at all, because of the fact that I thought the candle not only sparked, it didn't light, it seemed to spark. And then the blanket gets pulled back, and then her top gets partially opened. A dream doesn't happen that way.
Okay, we're going to have to rewatch this again.
Yes, because I saw the, you know, the blanket comes back, and then the shirt opens up, and, you know, what happens when the shirt opens up?
What episode do you watch it?
I don't know.
I mean, this is being censored in the UK if the shirt opened up.
Oh, I can tell you, well, I'll have to find it, but I can tell you exactly where to look on your video, because yes, the blanket opens, her blanket comes open, and her shirt comes open, and my guess is he probably, you know, reached a invisible hand inside.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right.
Okay, there is enough happens visually in this scene in her bedroom that it makes it clear it's not a dream, but the understanding that Beverly has at this point, the only thing that makes any sense at all is a dream. Although I do have to wonder, didn't Deanna kind of have a few questions around this? Because Deanna Troi is the one person on the ship who was previously impregnated by a presence.
Hmm. Yeah, but she's not thinking of it as a presence. She just thinks of it as a dream because that's the way it was described. This was real. It was physical. Therefore, it's rape. Just because she didn't realize her shirt was being opened at the time, what did he do? I mean, yeah, nobody was really there physically for her to see.
We're making a jump. It's still not necessarily rape. Like, you imagine in her dream that maybe she obviously enjoyed whatever was happening. I don't know where's the line drawn on consent. It's not enjoyment, obviously, but where is it? Where is that line?
The fact she was never asked in the first place says to me there was no consent.
But do you
it
ask?
It just happened.
Well, yes.
That's the weird thing. That's the oddity, right? Like, I don't ask my wife every time that we do that act, right?
Whoa.
I don't say you want to go. Like, sometimes we just go into it, right? Well, like,
that's true, because you both knew it was coming. However, Beverly had no idea this was coming at all. And the fact, if she knew that, why'd my blanket go down? Why is my shirt open? Why do I feel like I'm being fondled? Then that would be a whole different thing than a dream.
Yeah, she's been misled into thinking it's a dream, because that's where she is in her head at that point. It's not
nobody was there.
She doesn't understand what is happening at the time. Therefore, she's not in a position to give consent.
Nope.
We're assuming here this is a physical thing, right?
Whereas it had to be with the shirt and the blanket.
Yeah, okay. I've watched the scene, and yes, the blanket gets pulled off, and the shirt comes slightly down at the shoulder. But then she wakes up, right? And so it's not as if it then, you know, the action then starts from that point. It looks like that she kind of wakes up startled, after having had had a particularly erotic dream.
Yeah, he saves her 8 bit for the second meeting.
Well, it seems like she woke up awfully quick from the time the shirt goes down. So, I mean, but I guess if you bump your wife at 3 a.m., she's going to, you know, she's going to wake up from it too.
Okay. Does anyone want to come in at that point? Or shall we move on?
Genuinely, I'm slightly disturbed by the fact this is four men discussing this. I feel like we should get
that's, yeah, no, that's very
yeah. Okay.
Hey, we are all married though, right? I
know. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yes. Okay. Well, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed awfully pretty physical and. Okay, what else we got?
Beverly beams down, puts some flowers at the graveyard. Yeah. Ned does start going on about we'll be burying another Howard woman, but you know what? In 70 years' time, at this point, I'm generally on Team Ghost rather than Team Ned. I have to say, and at the same time that this is all going on, right? You're beginning to have the subplot of there's. You know, hold on to your hat. There might be a storm brewing in Scotland, which must be inconceivable for these people.
That's my favourite. But somebody in this episode even references the fact that the storms are making it a little too late Scotland for the like. the whole making this colony, it's a terraformed colony, if I remember what they said. So
yeah.
They built it in such a way it's supposed to be like the Highlands of Scotland, and then they went and got people from Edinburgh, Glasgow, Aberdeen, none of which are in the Highlands. You missed Inverness if you want a Highland city. The founders wanted to truly recreate Scotland, except for the weather. So Ronan says he was originally from Glasgow.
Yes. Yeah.
So he has a perfect understanding of the weather in Scotland. So if he's the one creating these storms, yeah, fair enough. Totally agree with that. I don't understand why this colony seems to be built in like 17th century Scotland, though. This is one of the problems with this episode, is that there's a perception of what Scottish is, and it's 300 years out of date at least. And the Irish had same problem. We get from now, yeah, so it's about 700 years out of date for them. The Irish had the same problem with, was it Up the Long Ladder in season 2, where there was basically a colony of Irish farmers like the potato famine time at best. Who knew people fled the famine in the 1800s to go to another planet?
So across the street from the cemetery, was it a McDonald's or something?
No, but we've skipped this. For the very first time, I noticed in this episode, rewatching it, right at the start when Picard is talking to the Maturin guy, he's standing next to a gravestone that says Vader. And later on, you also see Ronan standing next to that same gravestone. And if you look to the other side of him, there's one that says McFly.
So hang on, just to be clear here, McFly isn't a traditional Scottish surname.
I think it's a traditional Irish surname, isn't it? Back to the Future 3.
Is it even a, what's it? Is it even a real name?
I don't know.
Back to the Future it is.
Yeah, I know, but I mean...
funnily enough, the name Howard isn't Scottish. So, and this whole episode is a bit of a misnomer with that, because Howard's like an English name, I think. Ironically, McFadden is a Scottish name. So if they just went with the actress's name, might have got away with it instead. But maybe that would have been a bit too on the nose to have Beverly McFadden.
Howard's English name.
Okay, alright.
Yeah, but
I want to talk about names coming from Scotland, because my name's Polish, so...
No, but it's also not going to be the case that you won't find, you will find Howards in Scotland now and 200 years ago and 300 years ago and, whatever. It's not that the dividing lines are so rigid.
So what do you guys think of Ned's goofy hat?
See, this is exactly it. This is another, 17th century Scotland thing. Nobody wears those hats except for the football. Where we somehow regress.
But you also have hair added to the hat with the football, though, right?
Yes, the See You Jimmy hat.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure was once an insult for Scots, See You Jimmy, and we just kind of owned it.
So, Lou, if you could just put this link into the show notes, because this is the, at about 15 minutes ago or so, when Chris and I had a bit of a laugh, this is who Ned reminds me of, and it is an advert from the UK from 25 years ago, and it does appear to have the guy from this episode in it.
Oh, really? The same guy?
Well,
it looks like it.
not quite, but the same caricature that they're going to.
Wow, I see. Oh, you guys must hate people that spoof the Scots and the kilt and all. That must drive you guys nuts.
It doesn't bother me. It's just if you're going to represent Scots, then representing them in the way we are. But actually, dressing us up in kilts and these hats and all that is just what we do at the football. I swear we parody ourselves sometimes.
All right. Okay, so she visits, like you said, she visits a grave site, and Ned tries again. Don't light the candle. Don't go to the house. Or we'll bury another Howard. But then a wicked storm forms, and she runs home, or back to the house. And finds, is it my imagination, or were there a lot of flowers in that house?
There was a lot of flowers at the grave as well. Yeah. They just magically appeared, and then they were magically in the house as well. This is the supposed to give us the impression that Ronan's fallen Beverly. Is Ronan also carrying an umbrella for Beverly during all this? Because there's a big storm outside, and yet Beverly is not wet at all, which is ironic given the dream she was having the previous night.
Very good, very good. So I was distinctly under the impression that the flowers were supposed to be spooky flowers. I mean, did I misinterpret that? I thought they were Ronin's.
They were, yeah, I think so. They're not. Like, I don't know how you get spooky flowers, but yeah, I think they've come from the ghost in inverted commas.
Yeah. Probably. Okay. So she arrives back at the house, and here's the voice of the man, the ghost. She sees his reflection in a mirror, I believe. And then what was the direction? What did Jonathan have to say when she was sitting in there and acting like she was having sex with air that entered her from in front of her? How did that direction go?
Incredibly entertaining, I suppose.
Yeah, I thought it went pretty well.
Did you? This is one of those facepalm moments for me, as she's, you know, nearing orgasm with this air vapor that entered her, and I'm like, this is so cheesy. And you guys all three thought, yeah, that looks good to me.
I don't think this happens. There's no air vapor entering her at this point.
Yeah, I didn't get an air vapor thing.
That's later on, right? That's when Picard walks in.
Yes.
There.
Yeah. Yeah, because she gets the green eyes at that point.
Yeah, so at this point, she just has a bit of a thing around the, you know, they have a bit of a, she does see the reflection, but then she kind of, I think the next scene we cut to is when Troy kind of pops around, and you can tell that Troy's, it looks like she's on her way for her morning, you know, morning exercises, mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, but before I start, how was the any dreams to report? What happened last night? Let me know. So she gets pressed again on anything that might have happened in her grandmother's diary.
Well, see, hold on now. I'm using 5 second five second intermittents to look at what happens during this storm. You're right. She's not wet, by the way, but as she's going on, it's like she's thrusting as if he keeps bitch slapping her. But obviously he's doing something to her because she's having real reactions, like some pain or, you know, like there's an assault going on. That's what it looks like to me.
But this is the most disturbing bit, because she's doing all this while having a conversation of trying to understand who he is and what's going on, because this is where we find out he's come from Glasgow. He's been with the Howard woman for 800 years now. How does that work, by the way? Do they have to have procreated first and then he's with them? I'm assuming he doesn't make Howard, the subsequent Howard woman, and this is doesn't a form of incest in this creepy story as well. The line of women already procreated, children are there. So then the male of the Howard clan disappears, and then the ghost takes over. Or the Howard woman leaves the father of the children to be with the ghost.
So I always imagined the way it worked, that, you know, given the way the biology is set up, he kind of hung around with the widows. I would imagine he spends his time with the widows, right? Just in the older age bracket, as you know, as one of them dies off, that's the next generation's dad is probably not there, or you know, at worst case scenario, comes to an untimely death or an untimely accident.
There could be a whole side story with that, where the fathers mysteriously start dying off at a certain age, unless he does just prefer the geriatrics.
Exactly how did Jack Crusher die?
Settling for Beverly.
I don't know, but what I'm saying is just watching her reactions and the fact that she's walking around this house, like I said, it's like she's getting bitch slapped around by this guy until she finally succumbs to his charms or his wishes.
Okay, so I do have to say, I think that this is the this is a bit of a strange one because you know, Crush is obviously the main protagonist that we're following this episode. She's a member of the crew. She's going to be hyper rational. She's going to be a member of Starfleet. You know, very intelligent, etc., etc. But basically, during this scene, a ghost basically tells her, "Hey, I'm a ghost. I've been with all of your ancestors for the last 800 years. You want to get it on?" And she seems to take that quite in her stride, wow. A lot more in her stride than I was expecting her to take it.
Yeah, sure. Why not? That sounds good to me. I've been looking for a ghost all my life, and you sound like the right one for me. Oh, man.
He's definitely hitting all the right buttons. She says that even after the first encounter, that he knows how she wants to be touched.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it obviously has the desired effect to remarkable amount of effect, to be honest, because maybe not after the second encounter, but certainly by later on, she's quitting her job and moving to this colony just to spend her time with him. There's like a switch when that happens. It's almost as if she still has her doubts even after that second encounter, when she's obviously enjoyed the time, but she's still able to have the conversation with Deanna about this being unusual and the shared traumatic experience. And she's obviously looking at it as Ronan is still just a normal person because Deanna doesn't know the ghost side of things. But there's still a rational Beverly at that point.
You certainly have two facets of Beverly at this point, right? You have the fact that she goes home, she closes the door, and then she knows that she's doing this experience with a ghost. At the same time, when she's talking to her therapist, she's not volunteering the ghost part of the discussion, even though she is talking about, you know, the relationship. I have to say that, I mean, apart from the fact that Troy doesn't pick up on the ghost, so if we just park the ghost thing for a second, Troy is a good counselor in this. She tells her exactly what, you know, to be aware of, and she's not getting, you know, Troy is getting extremely excited, right, about the possibility of Beverly having a bit of a fling on the side. But she gives good advice and says, look, you have to make sure you don't just, you know, both of you have been under a lot of emotional stress. Don't just fall into each other's arms because it might not be real, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, props to Troy again.
Okay. Props to Troy. Okay. So,
by the way, we then move into two of the stupidest things.
The fog.
Okay. One, the fog. Two, the sneeze. Look, I'm happy to take the ghost. I'm happy to take the green mist entering Beverly as she's sitting there rocking in a chair. But this, what the hell is this about?
The fog.
It makes no sense.
Was it anaphasic fog? I mean, what would have caused it?
There was something about a feedback on the data, not the power transfer that they had to the station. So,
yeah, but
only on the bridge.
Does anyone need this? Right?
No. It leads to a really annoying dick comment from Picard where he says, "I'm going to get my jacket." He's the only person in the crew that has a jacket other than Beverly. The rest of them just have to make do.
Yeah.
But I thought the uniforms were supposed to be also like all-weather uniforms, right? That's why they beam down the planet without jackets. They're as light in as areas as they need to be, and they're as warm and comfortable as they need to be.
Except for when they need to look.
Yeah, yeah. But the idea that someone in the production team or in the writers' team was thinking, look, if we don't have fog on the bridge, people aren't going to recognize that it's Star Trek or whatever the thought process was. But it's just a little bit silly. And the other thing that comes up as well, you know, when you're thinking about this, they obviously went and, you know, there's not an infinite amount of money you can spend on these shows. But they chose to bring in fog. And they also chose to make the governor an alien. And I've there's no reason why he has to be an alien, right? However many days he is shot for, why would they want to spend an extra, you know, $5,000 or whatever it's going to be to get him to put on the prosthetics? It seemed to be lacking. I think they didn't have Worf in this episode, which again, you're keeping the budget under control, right? But why they are bringing this guy in with his alien look, which is completely irrelevant to the episode. I mean, I suppose they're only doing it to remind people that you're not watching a gothic horror show, you're watching Star Trek. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it is the comfort that you need, I think, at times. Because this is kind of an off-the-beaten-track Star Trek story, and so they know we have to reel them back in and let them know, hey, this is still Star Trek occasionally. So mm-hmm. while you say it's only for that, I think that is still a big deal.
Yeah. No, I
mean, get what you're saying, though, because he's kind of the substitute for the, like, American businessman who wants to find his Scottish roots. It's the same sort of idea, like, oh, I love Scotland, so I'm going to make this entire planet about them.
That might be true. That might be true.
So you could easily have had, like, somebody from, like, your standard North American human character that happens to have Scottish ancestors, so he went out of his way to terraform this colony as a Scottish colony.
I didn't grasp that he was the guy who set this up, though. Is that what they're doing?
No, I don't think he was the one that terraformed it, but he was certainly, like, he was obviously the governor, so he kind of was heavily involved in it.
Right. I like and don't like that piece. And y'all were talking about this guy earlier, and I didn't jump in. I said earlier that my only issue with this was the rationalist, like, argument. But there's also this concept of, like, cultural tourism, right? Like, the Scottish culture is something that we ogle at, and you guys kind of laughed about it earlier, right? Like, do you get mad when kilts and sporrans and things like that are just thrown on anybody, and there's all these weird stereotypes and whatnot? But I think that culture matters, and particular cultures, when they create something beautiful or significant or worthwhile, we do want to look at them and understand them, because there's something in us innately that recognizes that beauty and things that were created or crafted over a long period of time amongst a singular people who were relatively similar, right, for a time, are important. There's something important to that. There's something significant in the creation of that cultural touch point. And so I really love that part of this episode as well, of recognizing that there is a Celtic tradition, there is a stereotype there for a reason, and it is a beautiful thing in and of itself. And so there would be people who would want to create entire planets that are basically giant museums of people living in this way, to pay homage to this wonderfully crafted thing. So I like it. I think that's a great thing. And I didn't get to mention that earlier, so I wanted to bring it back up now, because it was one of the big points that I wanted to make about the story. But I don't know that you need the guy to be an alien, to the doctor's point.
Is there actually anybody in this episode that's wearing a kilt?
I didn't think there was.
There's certainly the kind of tartan, whatever the thing over the shoulder's called. There's tartan in the episode, but I don't think anybody's wearing a kilt. I think everybody's got trousers on, and it was kind of the one thing I was kind of clinging to, that at least that bit was normal, because we don't wear kilts normally.
Nobody had it.
Did they have bagpipes? They must have had bagpipes during the funeral.
I don't think they did. Which actually is unusual in itself, because the first funeral that was seen in Star Trek was, well, the second funeral that was seen in Star Trek was Spock's, and I had Scotty playing the bagpipes at it. So it's not as if we haven't had bagpipes in Star Trek.
Then I can only assume they couldn't find them, rather than they made a decision you know, to recognize that the stereotype is not always applicable.
We're going to do it, they should have done it at the funeral, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would have made the most sense. Because, again, it would have also tied into Star Trek quite well because of the Rathacan ending. Right. Just to finish off the part about stereotypes, we don't have videos on this call. But if we did, you would see no fewer than 4 kilts hanging up behind me right now. I am that stereotype at times. I haven't worn any of them in years, but there's 4 of them. I'm excessive though. I have one that was made particularly for my wedding. I have another one that mum gave me for football. Again, see what I mean about us being a parody? And I think I've got 2 that I acquired along the years of going to weddings before I got married myself. I have 4 kilts hanging up behind me.
So talking about kilts, by the way, I think the closest thing you have to a kilt in this episode is actually Picard's dress uniform, which effectively is a kilt, right? I've always interpreted the dress uniform to stem from that tradition. In any case,
which does lead you to the question: what do they wear under the dress uniform?
Come on, yes. Man. We all know.
Why did they wear their dress uniforms? Was she a Starfleet member?
Well, if you're asked to go to a funeral, you're not going to wear your best gear, yeah. Right?
Especially the funeral of a beloved crew member who lived to an age that is not normal for a human.
Well, then she's supposed to have died at by the way, I don't know if you guys know, but the actress that played Nana also died. She died like at 101, 102, something like that. Which was basically the same age as the character that died in the episode. Although I think that they're not, they say over 100 rather than any specific age. But isn't like over 100 though relatively young for a 24th century female? I mean, if McCoy is living to 140 or however long it was,
that's fair. They did set the precedent for that. And that would make the guy's contention that you're going to be another one dead.
Yeah, they weren't thinking that
more powerful. I still wish they would have been like she was 60 or something crazy.
She was only 100.
Yeah, she was only 100. That makes sense.
Yeah, so the Memory Alpha entry mentions that the gravestone says that she was born in 2291, which would make her only 79. But it was said in the episode that it was over 100. And again, Memory Alpha does corroborate what James is saying about the fact that it's funny that she would have been 79 according to that birth year. The actress was 80 at the time that she played this. And you're right, and she'd love to be over 100 years old herself. So yeah, that's good innings, as I say.
Okay, by the way, as we've been chatting and having fun, I have been clicking through Memory Alpha, which I normally do not do. But the governor is Patrick from Statistical Probabilities on DS9. I had no idea.
I never saw that one, no. That's...
So you know
the Shakar bit I knew, I didn't realise that was Patrick. Well,
yes. So, Lou, you know the guy that, you know, the genetic, quote-unquote genetic freaks that they find after Bashir?
Oh, yes!
He's the older gentleman.
Oh.
I mean, okay. I thought he was awesome. And I love that character. I think he's very good. And
they're all cool. Idea.
He's also Hrothgar from Heroes and Demons and Voyager.
Yeah, but that's less memorable.
Oh, Heroes and Demons is a brilliant episode.
We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm putting it in right now. Me and Chris rejoin you for that episode when it comes.
Well, let's hope we're all still around in 14 years when we get to that. Okay. So, what about the sneeze?
The sneeze is just stupid.
Yeah. That was no man's sneeze. Anyway. Okay.
And then, maybe we should pick up the pace a little bit, but, Ned ends up on the... How does Ned get onto the Enterprise? I know that Worf's not in this episode, but he gets
Hallelujah!
he gets into the place where Geordi and Data are doing their thing. He gets electrocuted by the ghost. I mean,
right, so that's not the Enterprise. That's the weather control on the planet. And Ned seems to get everywhere on the planet.
Okay, I stand correct. I thought that was the Enterprise.
Oh, I thought that was the Enterprise too.
That's pretty like okay. That makes more
maybe dress the set a little better, but I was gonna make that point because I asked that same question and rewound earlier.
Oh,
but this also goes back to proving the point about Beverly still very sort of that split between Beverly and the horny Beverly and Beverly doing her job because she identifies that the discharge didn't kill them, but immediately comes to the conclusion. I need to go and speak to Ronan about this because I think he was involved, which he then does admit, but because she's basically been turned on again, she ignores the fact that he's just admitted to killing Ned.
Yeah, so I think it's at this point where I kind of depart from Beverly. So, you know, up until now, she's getting a little bit carried away. Maybe she's doing things that is not expected, but at this point, which is, the person, you know, yeah, we'll send the person up for an autopsy or for a check. Dr. Salah can take care of it. I've got other matters to attend. And she runs back home. And I mean, I don't want to come across sexist or juvenile here. But she's very, she behaves in a very immature manner, right? Around.
I don't know. I don't think there was anything wrong in Beverly doing that because Beverly had a very good inkling as to what had happened to Ned. So she went to the source of that to check to see if Ronan had indeed been involved in it. Unfortunately, that point is when her libido takes over and she just goes to pieces, which she starts humping his hand and all sorts.
Yeah, but then straight after that, she's told to go up to the Enterprise to light the candle. So she runs up to the Enterprise. She's sitting there on the side of her bed going, oh, is he going to phone me? Is he going to phone me? Is he going to phone me? I kind of felt that that's a bit like, you know, she's more of a developed character than, or she should be more of a stronger character than that. But of course, I appreciate she's been put in a very unique position with a, you know, with a ghost or with a demon kind of, you know, pretty much controlling her in this show.
But is this really too far removed from reality? Because I don't know. The reason teenagers act like that is usually because they aren't used to handling the increasing hormones or whatever the physical changes within the body are. I'm not an expert in the human body, unfortunately. As you get older, you get used to handling that. But if you had something like a green ghost who could dial that up several more notches, would you then again be ruled by the lower half of your body than the upper half?
Are we talking here about Insurrection? Isn't that what isn't that what they showed there?
To some extent, yeah, I guess it could be.
Okay,
man. I hope you're not bringing Insurrection to make us fall away from our arguments because you think Insurrection is bad. Because I am a firm defender of Insurrection and the greatness thereof.
I like Insurrection. I like it a lot.
Insurrection is a hidden gem.
Yes.
It's amazing. Music, I listen to that album all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, I'm gonna mention that I don't think Insurrection is the most awesome Star Trek film ever.
It is.
And I have to say that, I mean, there are problems with Insurrection that you could have solved, and you also have problems with Nemesis that you could have solved had you just thought and had a bit more time and just solved the problems. It's not like a structural problem with the episode. It's like a lazy problem. It's a miss shot of someone thinking something was funny. Do they do the HMS Pinafore, or what do they do? I think that entire scene at the beginning is.
I love that scene.
That's brilliant. It's horrendous.
it's absolutely nail on TNG. It's, I think, yeah. This is the thing. It's not Insurrection isn't the big blockbuster movie that some of the others are. It's like a long TNG episode, and people hit it over the head with that as if that's a bad thing. It's not. It's a really good TNG episode.
No, I hear that. And also, I mean, the big... Something that I don't really hear people talk about with Insurrection, and I don't know whether it's because I'm over-analyzing it, or but Insurrection's the final piece of work that Michael Piller did, right, whilst he was dying, and it's a Fountain of Youth storyline, and all of the stuff that kind of comes from, you know, from Offset, I am very kind of generous in allowing certain things to slip through. You know, yes, it's not got the Borg in it. There's not as much, excitement maybe as some of the others. But I do have a soft spot for it. I do have to say, there are missteps, but I'm not a hater of that film.
For me, the worst thing in that movie is the CGI. I think it never looked great, not even when it was first out. It just doesn't seem to match up with like the quality of other Star Trek productions. That and the fact that Riker controls the Enterprise with a Microsoft Sidewinder joystick.
Yeah,
I can't unsee that.
Okay, I'm gonna be. I think I might be controversial here. Is the best CGI nowadays even as good as the best model work in the 90s?
No. No,
I don't think it is.
You can do more with CGI, and Deep Space Nine is a good example of what you can do with it. But the model work is always far superior. You just can't do as much with it, which is why, like Wrath of Khan,
I think looks fantastic, but you don't
move the ships much.
I think that the battles in Wrath of Khan look better than the battles in Into Darkness or in Discovery. I can't get behind this hyper resolution based, like, kinetic battle scenes. It doesn't work for me. It just feels that it's off, and it feels like there's a disconnect. And you see things in whether it's Star Trek 08, 09, 08, or whether it's Discovery or any of the other kind of modern shows. And yeah, you know, they're throwing a lot of processing power at rendering that. I don't think anything's looked better than the high level budget fights that they had with the Enterprise in Wrath of Khan. And I mean, I'm going to get some hate for it, but the shots they get in the motion picture are good. The shots they get, you know, the beauty shots of the Enterprise and of the D that they get in TNG. Are good, and I don't think they're bettered by CGI.
I always love the criticism that motion picture gets for just being Starship porn, as if Starship porn's a bad thing.
Yeah,
motion picture. I can tell much of for ages. I think it also helps that is my favourite Enterprise of all. The refit Constitution class is beautiful, and it will always be my favourite.
Oh, again, I mean, whilst we're talking about controversial opinions here, am I the only one on the call that thinks that the E is not as good as the D?
Oh, yeah, no, I disagree. I never liked the D.
Oh, no, the D's lovely.
The D's weird looking to me. It was that deflector dish. I could never wrap my head around what that's supposed to be.
It seems like the D is more of a luxury liner and the E is more like a real, what you could... I call a real Starfleet ship.
Let's hope not. I think that in the 80s, there was still a commitment to beauty and efficiency. And since then, we've had this like all hard lines and efficiency kind of mindset. And so I think that the D is the most beautiful. It's probably the best starship ever created. It took what they created in the 60s with that UFO kind of concept, and it just like extrapolated it in a beautiful way. And the deck, I love everything about the Enterprise D. I think you're right on that. I'm with you.
Yeah, I like the D. And I also like, I have to say, I think the aesthetic of the TNG era is the you know, I'm specifically talking about the Elcars stuff here. And don't get me started on how it's infinitely better to have Elcars versus whatever the interactions they had in Picard in particular. I mean, you ain't going to be watching Picard in 15 years' time and not seeing that as just... it'll date the production.
I am staying out of this one because I used to be one of these people that thought, how does the Elcar stuff work? You don't get any feedback on it.
It doesn't
matter. How do you know if you press the button or not? And now I spend all my time on my phone doing exactly the same thing. So I don't know. If that's where we're going in 15, 20 years, I'll just need to get used to it. It looks weird now. It might not look weird then.
Anyway, were we watching Sub Rosa?
Well, yeah, we said we were going to speed this episode up, and then we went on like a 40-minute diatribe on some other shit.
Yeah, that tends to happen here.
So, but wait, we're near the end, right? So, yeah. Crusher resigns, heads down. The card gets a bit stroppy, and then follows her down in the middle of the night to walk in on her while she is getting down to business in her front room.
And he just walked right in. Yeah, he just walked right in. I mean, he did knock, but then instead of saying, "Well, she must be sleeping and leaving," he just lets himself in.
I don't know if I should.
Yeah, he did the right thing.
Did he?
Yeah,
he did the right thing.
He absolutely did the right thing, and especially if we go with our earlier assessment. And I wouldn't go with the rape analogy. I don't think that works. I still, even now, can't make that work in my mind, and I think that it confuses a lot of what this is. This is a predatory relationship. I will agree on that. And he knows that his friend has been overcome by something that is not her, that is not allowing her to. So maybe an abusive relationship in some way, and he knows that his friend is being drawn into this thing. He can sense it, right? Like, and so he did the right thing. If my friend I know is in an abusive relationship and she refuses to answer the door, like, I want to go in and still help her, and barring kicking the door in, like, I'm probably gonna still walk in and be like, hey, is everything okay? And that's essentially what he wants to do, and I respect the card for that, for not just walking away and saying, well, I guess she's, you know, I gotta respect her boundaries here, the door's closed. No, she's in a very bad situation, and he has to help her.
Did we really get, or was, did the episode do a good enough job at really explaining Crusher's descent into this, whether it's abusive or whether it's controlling or whether it's, you know, whatever word we want to put onto it, relationship? I kind of like felt that it didn't really do that. It kind of felt that... you know, there are two aspects of it, right? There's how Crusher is viewed from those others in the show, and also what we see through Crusher's eyes. And I think that even the stuff that we saw through Crusher's eyes, yes, we see her interacting with the weird alien, and we obviously know that she has kind of, you know, she has flipped relatively recently on this to go all in on this. But I don't think that the episode does a good enough job at really explaining or presenting kind of the danger, the manipulation, the abuse, the kind of the threat that that the Crusher is in. And that's why I think that when you look at Picard, does Picard really think that there's a threat here other than he's surprised that she's quit her job? And because I don't think her quitting her job is enough of a threat to get him down onto the planet. Now, yes, of course, there are other things going on, but I don't think that the show presents that.
Well, he spoke to Deanna about it before he went down to the planet as well. So I think the his own feelings when he saw her after the resignation email just before she went to the planet, he then spoke to Deanna about it, and she was voicing her concerns as well. In fact, Deanna was almost coming away saying, I didn't try hard enough in my job. So, I know we praised Deanna earlier on, but I think Deanna's beating herself up about this. So I think by that point, yes, Picard has probably enough information to say, I have to go and speak to her now because I didn't get the chance to do it properly. I didn't have enough information at the time when she was standing on the transporter pad. So to go there, onto the planet, into her house, makes sense at that point. But I agree with what you're saying, James. I think there is a lot of... We are having to fill in the gaps of this episode ourselves to see what they were trying to do. Now, you can do that to a certain extent, but maybe it's difficult to do in a 42-minute episode, especially when you're then trying to fill in other bits with the weather machine breaking down on the planet and the fog in the bridge and stuff. Or maybe you could have had less of that and a bit more sort of, this is how Beverly went from being a completely rational person into being this... How do I say it? She's being run by... Abusive relationships, probably a good way to put it at this point, because there's certainly consent, but she's not in the right frame of mind to be really knowing what she's doing properly, because she has been manipulated into this position through hormones or whatever it is that's hyped up to 11.
Okay. What else have we got? Well, we have Geordi and Data beaming down to exhume the coffin.
Nothing quite says like early afternoon TV than exhume the corpse.
Yes, right. Yes.
But
what? Why didn't the grave collapse? When
I was going to ask that. The grave
doesn't collapse.
Okay, I think I thought that. I wondered that as well. But if I'm not mistaken, there's actually a vault that's put down first. And then, at least over here, I believe there's a vault that's put down, then the coffin goes in, and then the vault is sealed. So technically, the vault would still be there to give it the depth, space usage, and then the coffin was just beamed right out of the vault. But here's another question. There was a lot of dirt on that grave. Do they still need grave diggers in the 24th century, or couldn't they just beam the thing right into the spot? Or how, I guess, what would happen to the dirt around it if they could just beam it there? So I guess they really do have to dig the grave still.
Right, it might be a bit less manual, but yeah, you could probably phaser it or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, technically, you could evaporate the corpse if you wanted to. So I'm sure they don't need grave diggers per se. But, I mean, this seems to be a traditional, it's a traditional setting, right? I have to say, by the way, I am so sold on this idea of the imagery of Nana waking up and then zapping. I mean, that's okay, isn't it? I mean, it's a guilty pleasure of mine. I like that when the corpse comes back to life.
I like it. I feel like it should have been scarier than it was, though.
Like her head spins around a couple times.
I don't know. I think I would have ruined it.
Yeah.
Jumped out of the coffin and grabbed Beverly by the throat.
I don't actually think that the corpse is particularly corpse-like.
No. Well, right. She hasn't been there long enough.
Yeah, no, but even by the time, I mean, I don't know how long they've been laid in to rest, but unless he died like earlier that morning, generally the corpse is in pretty decent shape.
Yeah, you're right there. Well, I don't know. How long is the embalming process going to make him look somewhat normal, so to speak?
And I appreciate this. I mean, sometimes these nitpicky things are a little bit unfair, right? Because what are they going to do? Actually use a corpse? No, they're not. The same thing that ever since we've had kids, whenever we see a child being born on TV, it's always like, nah, at least 3 weeks old.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what are you going to do? Are you really going to have a baby actually be born on camera? No, you're not. Are you, you know, that the baby can support its own head by the time he gets picked up by the mother. It's clearly that there are certain limitations on what you can technically do whilst being, you know, a fully paid-up member of the actors' union, right? You can't bring corpses and babies onto the set. I appreciate that.
Suppose not. Okay. Well then, okay, so they beam down, there's an anaphasic signature coming from Nana's grave, and it's coming from, is it Nana herself?
Yeah.
Okay, so Beverly arrives with the candle. And she figures out this Ronan needs a human host to actually stay alive. How did he stay alive if she was able to, and she does, she phasers a candle. How was he able to stay alive while the candle was actually out?
With great difficulty. I think it kind of hints at that earlier on in the episode, that he found it very difficult to take corporeal form when the candle was out. I don't know if he then found it easier to do if the candle was lit.
I mean, by the way, isn't this guy just extremely lucky that Beverly even turned up at all? Now, what would have happened if the Enterprise was a couple of light years further away? He just dies and we don't have this wonderful sideshow for a couple of days?
Also, what was the plan next? What if what was he going to live with Beverly for the next 70 years and then
go to Crush Wesley? Go to Wesley. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I don't see your point.
I'm just wondering out loud, to be honest. Maybe Wesley by that point is children of his own, has another daughter, and he can continue that line of sexual preference.
Well, we never know. But we'll never find out because she phases them into bits.
Can you really phaser a ghost? I mean, this is the bit where you shift out of the ghost story and into the alien story, right? I know that they kind of, and I've suggested that I kind of need this to happen in order for it to be quote unquote Star Trek. But the idea of it's not so much the idea of phasering the guy, but the idea of expecting that a phaser should work on the guy, right? Other than go straight through him.
There was an episode of the original series that had that, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but Kirk is beating himself up about not shooting this cloud when he was an ensign, and then he meets it again as a captain.
That's an obsession, series one.
Yeah,
and they're faced in the cloud.
Yeah, and it turns out when they shoot the cloud, nothing happens. So it wouldn't have happened.
Okay. I think I'm done. What about you?
I'm done, but I know, let's make sure that all of our guests have had ample opportunity to rebut the nonsense I have spouted.
Yeah, as I said earlier, Beverly snaps out of it because he starts harming people that she did genuinely care about, like Picard, like her Nana. So that makes sense to me. The last point about Ronan making these women happy, you've read that in a diary. You know it yourself. It's not real.
Did anybody get any delight out of the ghost torturing Geordi for a few seconds?
It was completely by the by as well. It's like, oh yeah, while I'm here, let me just...
I mean, there was a little bit of, comfort in that. But
he managed to fry Data as well, though. I would have been more concerned with that, but there's a throwaway line that Geordi and Data are fine, the colony's safe, Beverly's going to be okay as well, although it'll take her a bit longer because it's psychological rather than physical. But yeah, everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well then, I guess now it's time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And I think, for everyone's sake, I'm just going to get this over with and say torture, pure torture. I don't like it. I'm sorry. Some of the things you guys said actually make sense. I'm not going to... of course, you... this is some bad acting. I'm sorry. For Gates McFadden, this is some bad acting. Having to play, having sex with an air vapor had to be a little difficult, and I'm sure I don't know. I think the Beard of Power could have come up with some better direction than what he did on this one. So, to me, this is just torturous, and I never liked it. I never will. Do I give it a 1? Is it Shades of Grey bad? Maybe not. So, I was looking through my rating system, and I think I came up with one that was either a 1 or a 1.5, and the 1.5 was just as bad. So this isn't quite as bad either, so I'll go 1.75 for this episode. So I'm at 1.75. How about Mr. Johnson? Where are you at?
Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
I mean, here we go. Obviously a 5-star episode.
I'm kidding.
I think this episode tries a lot of things, and I don't know how much of the diatribe that I was trying to spit out earlier got through on the actual podcast feed before my internet completely crapped out. Maybe none of it. But my point was earlier that I think that they tried a lot of shorthand in this episode to make up for the fact that this is only a 40-minute episode. And they also wanted to do these kind of high-level horror themes with, like, demonic possession and other things, and then put it in a Star Trek concept or, like, scene. And I think that they mostly nailed it. And I think Gates McFadden did just fine with what she had here. I don't think the acting is that bad. I mean, it's TV-level acting. No, it's not making me cry. It's not putting the fear of God in me. But I've watched enough bad B-movie horror films to say that Gates McFadden can hold court with any number of those horror scream queens. She is fine here. And this episode is, for what it is absolutely a middle-of-the-road, decent Star Trek episode. So I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Okay, and Kitten McDuff. Do you still use that since there are no forums now?
I still use it on Twitter, yes.
Oh, okay. All right, your turn.
So, yeah, as a Scotsman, I have problems with this episode. They're not huge problems, because it's just that stereotypical sort of, this is what Scotland is, when we know Scotland's more modern than that. It's not a major issue with this episode, though, as much as I might make it out to be. As a human being, I probably find the rapiness a bit... I probably found it worse before we had this conversation, because I'm now seeing it more as an abusive relationship side of things. So it's still a bit uncomfortable how it gets to that point. But, okay, I'll accept that, because... as Chris rightly said, it does struggle with a 40-minute episode to get everything in, but still manages to hit as many nails in the head as it can. As a Star Trek fan, the concept of a ghost merging with women throughout the generations and pleasuring them into living a mutually beneficial life, I find that quite interesting. And as a man, I would quite happily watch an attractive woman like Gates McFadden. And this is season 7 Beverly Crusher, so she's particularly good at this point. Being sexually aroused all day, man, I'm fine with that. I could give it bonus points for that one. I'm almost surprised at myself that I'm going to give this at such a high rating, because Sub Rosa has become one of these episodes that is a joke to many people. But actually, when you sit and dissect it on a podcast like this, it's pretty good. And I'm now torn as to whether I go high or not, because I think it's at least a 3. I don't think it quite reaches 4.
No, I think
I'll probably settle with 3. But yeah, even that is a surprise, because I previously would have shipwrecked this one, to be honest. I don't think it belongs there. I think it's a good episode. And again, if you do think Sub Rosa's not great, have a conversation like this with somebody, and you might find it's actually not as bad as...
Okay.
Man, I missed 10 forward. Thanks for reminding me of that.
Dr. Roberts?
Hello.
How you doing?
Good, good.
Okay. It's all down to you, man. 1.75 or an average of 3? Where are you?
So the thing is that what one of the things that we often do on this show is that we come in feeling a long way apart, and then we will have discussions throughout the episode, and there are a number of things that can happen. One of the things that we can sometimes talk each other out of each other's positions. But I don't think that's necessarily happened today. But what has happened is that, I was always going to be coming into this episode going to be giving it a 2. And I think that's what it deserves. I think, though, that you would have probably expected me to be higher on the back of the fact that I've been defending the episode throughout the show. Whereas, you've come in and given it, 1.75, which is effectively a 2. And you've been saying that it's the most painful thing since, a colonoscopy. So in a way, it's odd that we speak very differently about something that we rate, at the same level. But no, I think this episode's, as we have said, there's some interesting stuff here. It's not the worst episode in the world. It doesn't really, hit particularly good highs, but it's certainly not the worst thing that has ever been produced. I think that for me to give it, anything higher than a 2, I would expect that the story, the threat that Beverly's under to be better communicated, and for us to have a bit more of a, I suppose, in what's the word I'm looking for? Probably more of a buy-in in what she's going through, and I think that that's something that doesn't particularly come across. So it was a perfectly reasonably enjoyable episode for 45 minutes. I don't think I'm going to go back to it. Tomorrow or to rewatch, but it's it wasn't too painful. So put me down for a 2 out of 5.
Okay, 2 out of 5. Okay,
but now this is where season 7 gets good.
Yeah, there are a few good ones. Okay, well then. I guess that is it. Chris Johnson, it should be more specific. Yes. You are pretty much bogarting the entire second half of the season, so I've got you down for the next one.
Lower Decks?
Yep.
Wow. All right. Is it just me?
No, I've got you with Colin.
Okay. Nice.
Have you two been together before?
I don't think
that's
we have.
That's a personal question.
I don't think we have, but I hope to light a candle with him next week.
Okay. That sounds good to me. Oh, God, I get it. Okay, got it. Good boy. You got me. Okay. Then I guess that's pretty much it. So everyone, join us next time as we review episode number 15. And as he said, it's called Lower Decks. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on. Nice discussion. And see, we're all still best friends. 1.75, a 2, and a 3. James said it right when he said, we're coming from way different areas, but yet we're still going close to the same scores. That's impressive.
Yeah, so. I feel like I made a new best friend. I always liked Kieran McDuff, but now I want to move to Scotland and live with the only Pollock Scotch that I know.
All right, guys. That's it. And good night.
Good night. Good night. Okay, I'm going to press the stop recording button.